With a quick, practiced hand, Gavin drafted a set of the special oars he used to propel the skull, but he clearly left room for Iron Fist to draft his own, which he did, albeit much more slowly. Meanwhile, Gavin drafted a bench for Kip and Liv to sit on, and straps to hold all the bags in the boat. Iron Fist wrinkled his nose at that, as if wondering why the bags would need to be strapped in, but he didn't ask. In moments, they were off. Gavin manned his oars, and Iron Fist manned his, and they sped out into the bay. The skull began veering to port almost immediately. It was Gavin's side. Kip realized that Iron Fist was rowing faster than Gavin, and the imbalance was driving them to port. Gavin looked over at Iron Fist, who grinned back at him, continuing to sweep huge long strokes with his arms and legs. Gavin sped up. So did Iron Fist. So did Gavin. Soon they were sculling across the water at a nice pace. Liv looked over at Kip.
Can you believe this? I've never gone this fast. What?
You'll see.
The men settled into a rhythm. They were going fast, competing, but neither trying to bury the other.
When are we going to meet your ship?
We're going to cross the sea on this.
Right. You've got more endurance than I thought.
Kip grinned. The big Parian clearly didn't believe Gavin, but was willing to play along. After 20 minutes, they were out of sight of any other ships. Barely slowing in his rowing, Gavin lifted one hand up and drafted one of the great tubes Kip had seen him use to propel the skimmer earlier. Iron Fist looked at it quizzically.
This is what I meant about your oath. Secrecy.
A tube attached to another tube. The secret is safe with me, O Prism. Hope it gets us out of this port turn, though.
Gavin dropped the tube into the water. The skimmer shot forward. The whole skimmer rose up, and Iron Fist almost fell over as his oars came free of the water. The skimmer sped up slowly and began to skip from one wave peak to the next. Then the skips got longer and longer, and soon the platform stopped hitting the waves at all. After a time, the astounded Iron Fist joined in, and they skimmed even faster. The water was so clear, Kip could see the tube cutting through the waves below them. Gavin had given each tube little wings. It was on those wings that the whole skimmer was flying above the surface. Hours later, when the sun was halfway to the horizon, Gavin decided to switch back to sculling before they came in sight of Garriston. As the skimmer settled back on the waves, Iron Fist stepped away from his tube. His face was a writ of wonder, awe. He actually physically trembled. Then he swept into an elaborate bow before Gavin.
Lord Prism, you have made the world small.
Small, maybe. Safe, no. Did you see a corvette over that way?
Iron Fist shook his head. Their watercraft, no longer lifted up by the action of the tubes, sat low in the water. But by the time Iron Fist had drafted new oars, a corvette appeared, a league away, plowing right toward them.
So, Kip, Liv, you ever fought pirates?
Surely you're joking, my Lord Prism.
Let's go hunting.
My Lord, I can't let you put yourself in that sort of danger. We can outrun these Elysian scum. They're not threatening our mission or us.
Do you know what this summer is, Commander?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
It's time for the Hrothgari handover of Garriston.
Do you know why she sounded so happy about that?
I've never served on this side of the Cerulean Sea.
I'm sure you know that each country that sided with me during the False Prism's War has rotating stewardship of Garriston.
2 years or something for each country, so no one gets long-term designs on Tyria. Can we have this conversation at a safer distance?
That's what it was supposed to do. Instead, each governor has taken it as a personal chance to get rich. The Parians had the first rotation, and they stripped Garriston of everything that survived the fires. Every governor since then has followed their lead.
During the first year, most governors try to keep the Umber River clear of bandits so the crops can get through. But most of the crops come in too late on the second year. The governors don't want to lose men killing bandits just to enrich the next governor from some other satrapy, so they withdraw into Garriston. Only the most optimistic farmers even bother planting on the second year anymore.
While repeated sacking of Garriston and the surrounding country is tragic, it doesn't have much to do with these pirates. The handover happens after Midsummer's, 2 weeks from now. The Hrothgari merchants and craftsmen and wives and whores are busily loading their ships to take whatever plunder they've managed to steal this time home. or just whatever they brought with them. I suppose just because every governor so far has been corrupt doesn't mean the Smiths who shoe their horses are too.
This is fascinating, but can't some long gun shoot 18 or 1900 paces?
It's farther away than that. Point is...
Finally, thank or holum.
There'll be an armada heading back to Hrothgar in 2 weeks. The pirates descend like wolves, and they take any ships that get separated from the main fleet.
Serves them right.
Gavin stared at Liv, and she scowled defiantly, but couldn't handle the eye contact, so she scowled at the waves.
Some merchants try to beat the rush and get out before the rest of the fleet, hoping they'll avoid the pirates.
But here they are.
Exactly. And if there's war this summer, especially, or holum forbid, if we lose, there'll be chaos. Dozens of ships, maybe hundreds, all going their own direction, fleeing. A lot of the people in those ships will be Tyrian, Oliviana.
Smoke!
Everyone turned to look.
It would take an extremely skilled gunner to come within 100 paces of us at this distance.
Maybe it was an empty charge, just to let us know.
That was quite a shot. The good news is that very few corvettes have more than one gun mounted on the front, so we should have at least 30 seconds while
they're... Smoke!
I hate this part.
Gavin and Iron Fist scrambled onto their oar apparatus. This time the splash was 50 paces in front of them.
Good to know the first one was lucky.
Unless the second one was unlucky.
Let's go! Right!
They began rowing and quickly picked up speed.
What can I do?
Smoke!
The water exploded 50 paces behind them.
Didn't expect us to come straight at them. Next one'll be closer.
Smoke!
The water exploded not 15 paces to the left. Kip actually felt spray.
See? Talented gunner.
It's a 6 count between the smoke and the splash.
Good. Iron Fist, hard starboard is soon.
The men cut hard to starboard, and the next shot splashed harmlessly a good distance away, albeit probably perilously close to where they would have been. The skull cut back and forth, sometimes even stopping, and though Kip's fear never really shrank, he saw that Gavin was right. Their skull was simply too fast, too small, too maneuverable to get hit. Unless the gunner made both a skillful and lucky shot. And though, as they got closer to the Elysian ship, they had less time to move between the cannon being fired and the shot landing, the gunners were also having to change their angle more and more. There was a long pause between shots.
What's going on?
Maybe they're tired of wasting powder.
10 seconds later, they had their answer, as twin columns of smoke erupted from the cannons.
Port!
Gavin had guessed right. Water erupted both where they would have been if they'd gone straight and where they would have been if they turned to starboard. Though it was longer between volleys, now the pirates could make 2 guesses of where the skull was headed instead of one.
Clever bastard! Time to cheat! Kip, switch me!
Gavin clambered off the oars and Kip jumped in.
Straight!
Blue flooded Gavin's skin, and he drafted a propulsion tube into the water. As before, they leapt forward. Gavin's teeth gritted under the strain of pushing the entire boat by himself, muscles knotting, veins standing out on his neck. But after a moment as they gained speed, it became easier.
Iron Fist! Put fire grenades in all the cannon holes in the sails. Liv, cut the rigging. Kip, you call out anything you think I don't see. Take my pistols.
Gavin pulled his hand from one of the tubes and drafted a basin and filled it with red Luxon in moments. Iron Fist instantly began drafting blue projectiles and filling them with the flammable goo. They traversed the last 500 paces before the men scrambling on deck could reload the front cannons. Only one man seemed unfazed by their impossible speed.
Oh, Musketeer!
As they got closer, Kip saw that the gunner was a Elysian. His knees were bent, compensating for the rolling motion of the deck as naturally as breathing. He fixed the burning fuse into place.
I said Musketeer!
They cut the water right beside the corvette as the cannon portholes opened and the ship turned hard away from them. Gavin just turned with the bigger vessel. No one was going to do anything. Kip cocked the hammers of Gavin's dagger pistols, trying not to skewer himself on the long blades. The musketeer pivoted smoothly, aiming at Gavin. Kit raised both pistols. The musketeer shot first. His gun exploded in his hands, knocking him off his feet. Kit pulled both triggers. The pistol in his right hand scraped the flint against the frizzen, but didn't throw a spark. The left-hand pistol kicked back at Kip with far more force than he'd expected. He slid toward the back of the skimmer, rolling, scrambling. He saw Liv flinging both of her hands forward, then turning, her pupils tiny pinpricks as she drafted Super Violet. Then she dove for him. Tumbling face down, Kip lost sight of Liv, the ship, the drafters, and the battle. All he saw was the slick blue of the skimmer's deck sliding away below him. His face slid over the edge. His nose went under, and positioned off the back of the skimmer as he was, his nostrils acted as twin scoops, jetting water up into his sinuses at great speed. Liv must have grabbed him because there was no third bounce, but Kip could see nothing, think of nothing. By the time he propped himself up, the Elysian Corvette was 200 paces behind them. Its sails sagged, cut and burning. Smoke billowed out of all the cannon portholes on the starboard side, and fire was visible on the decks. And the whole ship was sitting low in the water. Men were leaping off the decks on every side.
Men jumping off that fast means the fire must be headed for the... Powder Magazine. Sorry bastards.
Men like those kill and rape and steal and enslave. They don't deserve our pity. But Iron Fist's right. It's no easy thing to be the hand of justice.
He dropped the tube into the water.
We'll row the rest of the way. By the by, nice shot, Kip.
Did I hit him?
Blew the captain right off his wheel.
The wheel's at the back, right?
The musketeer had been at the front.
You weren't aiming at the captain, were you?
Aiming?
Oh, Olam have mercy. The nut doesn't fall far from the tree. However, luck is...
Luck is not dropping your father's priceless, one-of-a-kind pistols in the sea.
I dropped your pistol?
Whereas Slick is catching said pistol at the last moment.
Gavin produced the weapons from behind his back. He grinned.
Oh, thank Olam.
You still almost lost my pistols. And for that, you get to row. Liv, you too.
What?
You're his tutor. He's your responsibility. Everything he does wrong is on you.
Oh, perfect.
It looks so dirty.
After seeing the wealth of Big Jasper and the magical edifices of the Chromeria, Garrison looked decidedly unimpressive.
Dirt is the least of it.
He wasn't sure what that meant, but he was sorry that he'd been unconscious when he'd floated through the city the first time with Gavin. If he had seen Garrison then, it would have doubtless been impressive. It would have been the largest gathering of humanity he'd seen in his life, at least, if not the cleanest. Rectan's Alcaldesa would never have tolerated the heaps of trash Kip could see pushed into the alleys just off the docks, sitting right next to crates often holding food. Disgusting. The docks had perhaps 40 ships, half protected by a seawall with great gaps in it. Liv saw Kip looking at the holes, wondering if there was some purpose for them.
The occupiers never really want to break their backs helping out us backward Tyrians. The morgue is opposite the gaps in the seawall, given to locals. You should see the captain scurry when a winter storm comes. The soldiers gather up in the towers and take bets on whether the individual ships will break up.
The Skull, powered by Liv and Kip, cruised past galleys, galleasses, corvettes, and fishing dories, full of locals mending their nets. The men and women stopped their work at the sight of a Skull, especially a Skull with such an exotic crew. It warmed Kip just to see Tyrian faces again. It made him feel at home. Only as they went past did he see the hostility on those faces.
Where are we going?
Commander Iron Fist pointed to the most magnificent, tallest building in the city. From here, all Kip could see was the perfect egg-shaped tower with a spike pointing to heaven. A wide stripe around the widest part of the tower was inlaid with tiny round mirrors, none bigger than Kip's thumb. In the afternoon sun, the tower seemed to be on fire. Above and below that stripe of mirrors, similar stripes of other colors of glass were inlaid as well.
I sort of figured. What I meant was, where should we dock the Skull?
Right there.
Gavin pointed to a blank wall at the point nearest a gate. It wasn't a docking spot, and the level of the streets was a good 4 paces above the level of the water. Nonetheless, Kip and Liv steered, fairly expertly, Kip thought, toward the wall. The skull's nose dipped lower in the water as blue Luxon bloomed on the front of the boat and snaked out. It solidified as soon as it touched the wall and became steps, locking the skull in place and giving them easy egress.
I'm still not used to this whole magic thing.
I'm 38 years old and I'm not used to it. Just a little quicker to react. Grab your packs.
They did, and climbed the stairs to street level, while locals looked at them curiously. After they were all off, Gavin touched a corner of the stairs. All the Luxon in the skull lost coherence and dissolved, falling into the water as dust, grit, and goo, depending on its color. Gavin, of course, paid it all no heed.
Gavin, Lord Prism, why don't drafters wear Luxon?
They do, sometimes. Obviously, yellow breastplates and such are highly valued in battle, but I'm guessing you mean as clothes.
You use magic for everything.
That's me. A normal drafter isn't going to shorten her life just so she doesn't have to dock her skull another 50 paces out. Well, some would, of course. The truth is, there was a fashion of wearing Luxon clothing once, when I was a boy. With the application of enough will, even some kinds of sealed Luxon can become fairly flexible. Soon, there were drafter tailors who specialized in the clothing, but most people couldn't afford them, and if you make your own, there are any number of mistakes you can make. Some are fairly harmless, like making your pant legs too stiff. But if you made a mistake in the drafting, your shirt might dissolve into dust in the middle of a day. Or certain mischievous boys might learn how to unseal the Luxon that the tailor drafters had woven. These boys might have caused some chaos at a memorable party, where the ladies who'd gone to the expense of even having Luxon undergarments found themselves in particular distress. Sadly, the fashion ended rather abruptly after that.
That was you? I heard about that party.
I'm sure whatever you heard was much exaggerated.
No, it wasn't.
I was a bad child. Fortunately, I've come a long way since then. Now I'm a bad man.
His smile didn't touch his eyes.
Here we go.
Three Hrothgari men approached. The three all wore what looked to Kip like wool sheets with a hole cut for the head, carefully folded so there were pleats at their wide leather belts. The garment, a tunic, then fell to the men's knees. Though their legs were bare, the wool seemed entirely inappropriate for Tyria's climate, and all three were sweating freely. All wore leather sandals, though the guards laced up into shin armor. The guards each carried a pilum and a gladius and a crude pistol at their belts. The man in the lead, apparently in charge, had his tunic embroidered at the hem and on each breast. He carried a scroll, a large bag slung over one shoulder, and a heavy purse at his belt. He wore a pair of clear spectacles low on his nose. Clear spectacles? What kind of drafter would want clear spectacles? But as the men came close, Kip realized that the man wasn't a drafter at all. His eyes were clear brown. The men were also all pale, a common Hrothgari trait, Kip guessed. With their skin barely bronzed, they weren't pale or freckled like blood foresters, but they still seemed pretty ghostly. Their hair was a normal dark hue from brown to black, but straight and fine. They walked with either authority or hauteur. Kip glanced at Liv. She was definitely taking their attitude as the latter. She practically sneered at them. Kip thought she might spit at their feet.
I am the assistant portmaster. Where's your vessel? The tax is levied according to size and term of stay.
I'm afraid the size of our vessel is negligible at the moment.
I'll be the judge of that, thank you. Where'd you dock?
Right about there.
The assistant portmaster looked, then glanced up and down the wall, squinting. There were no ships within 50 paces. He folded his arms, his jaw setting as if Gavin were making fun of him.
The tax isn't heavy, but let me assure you, the penalty for attempting to evade taxation is...
One of the guards tapped the assistant portmaster's shoulder, but the man ignored him.
As it should be.
Gavin handed over a letter. The man held the letter low, so he was looking through his spectacles, like he was going to draft the letters right into words.
Oh.
The man's head snapped up. and he peered at Gavin's eyes through his spectacles.
Oh, my lord Prism, 1,000 pardons. Please, my lord, let us accompany you to the fortress. It would be a great honor for us.
Gavin inclined his head.
I sort of thought you'd pick them all up with magic and shake them or something.
There's a time to toss idiots around, but this man's just doing his job.
They walked into the shadow of the fortress, whose northern wall nearly overhung the harbor. Kip and Gavin both looked up. There were archers walking along the top of the wall, looking down at them.
Besides, you start throwing Luxon around, you never know who's going to answer with gunfire.
The assistant talked to the men guarding the gate. Lots of furtive glances at Gavin followed. Kip was busy looking at the fortress. The gate and the entire fortress was carved travertine. Mellow green, incised with a crosshatched pattern to make the stone look woven rather than carved. There were a number of murder holes cut in the gate. As the soldiers opened the gate, Kip saw that it led to a short killing ground, entirely enclosed, with murder holes everywhere, then another gate. The guards at the second gate, which was open, carried muskets with almost bell-shaped muzzles. These guns were also shorter than the muskets the guards at the Chromeria carried. Kip was next to Iron Fist now.
Why are their muskets so short?
Blunderbusses. Instead of a ball, they load them with cobbler's nails or chain. At short range, you can hit 4 or 5 men. Or blow a good hole in one. Good for rioters. A man cut in half isn't any less dead than one with a small hole in his heart, but he's a much greater deterrent to everyone else in the crowd.
Nice.
After a few more checkpoints, at which they accrued a few more senior guards, they climbed several floors. When they were on the third floor, they passed an open door to chambers overlooking the sea. Gavin stopped abruptly. Their escorts didn't notice immediately. Ignoring them, Gavin walked into the room. Iron Fist, Kip, and Liv followed him. The room was a suite of apartments filled with paintings, pillows, screens with ornate paintings of hunts, fireplaces, several chandeliers, and great long-handled fans for room slaves to waft their masters. Everywhere Kip looked, things sparkled, shined, and gleamed. The escorts hurried in.
This will be sufficient.
Yes, Lord Prism, of course. This is the guest of honor's suite. We'll get...
For my servants. Kip, Liv, I trust you can stay out of trouble while I get our accommodations arranged.
Yes, of course, my Lord Prism.
Start Kip's drafting lessons. I'll check up on you after I've finished with a few things.
Of course.
Liv curtsied. Kip half bowed and instantly felt deeply foolish. He didn't know how to bow. No one bowed where he grew up.
Iron Fist, best chance you'll have to see a pompous Hrothgari governor get kicked out of his rooms. More if you're lucky. Might even be someone you know.
It's the simple pleasures that make life beautiful, isn't it?
The door closed behind them, and abruptly Kip and Liv were alone, away from the important people and the matters of state. Children once more. Liv looked at Kip for a long time.
What?
Sometimes it's really strange to me that you are who you are. A week ago I would have blushed just at seeing Commander Iron Fist. Now I'm sitting in the finest rooms in the Travertine Palace, and they're mine.
I've given up trying to understand it all. I think if I stop and think too much, things will just fall apart.
You were there, in the village, when it happened.
At Greenbridge, with Issa and Sanson. And Ram, of course. Ram and Issa were killed. Sanson and I got away, but eventually they killed him too. My mother made it out, but her skull was smashed. I was with her when she...
Kip, I'm so sorry.
Anyway, I really do hope your father got out. He was always good to me. In fact, if he hadn't made me leave when he did, I'd be dead.
Liv said nothing for a time. Kip couldn't decide if it was an awkward silence or not.
Kip, I've been trying to work up the nerve to... Things can be really complicated now, with who your father is and the way things are at the Chromeria. Sometimes things don't really go the way we want, and we...
Am I supposed to have some idea what you're talking about? 'Cause I...
She opened her mouth and looked at him again. Then he saw the gates come down.
I'm just really glad you made it out, Kip.
Thanks. Should we get started?
Sure. Come out to the balcony.
They walked out onto the balcony, which hung literally over the sea. Kip stood looking out at the sea, trying to put himself in a frame of mind to concentrate.
What do I do?
To draft, you need four things. Skill, will.
Source and still. Sorry, I have picked up a thing or two.
Right. So there's basically modifications and nuances to each of the big four. But that's where it all starts. Let's start with source.
Kip thought that he'd picked up a lot of what she was going to say, but one doesn't interrupt a beautiful girl, unless one is going to be funny. Liv rummaged through her pack and pulled out a rolled-up green cloth and then a white one.
We'll hold off on the color theory as much as we can. We know you've drafted green, so your source can either be something reflecting green light in the world, or you can take something that has green as a component color and look at it through a lens.
Huh? What do you mean, reflecting green? You mean something green?
Something you'll learn the further you go in the Chromeria is that your experience of a thing and the nature of the thing itself are often different things.
Sounds, metaphysical.
Some take it that way, too, but I'm speaking strictly physically. Look at this.
Liv pulled out another cloth. It was a red spectrum, but instead of flowing smoothly from the deepest to the lightest red, there were parts that took steps back.
When you look at this, Kip, you can tell that it's off. It generally goes right, but there are sub-colors out of sequence. Most men can't see that. They think it's right. They can differentiate these four spectral blocks here, but not these blocks inside. It doesn't matter how hard they try or how long they study it. Their experience of it is less nuanced than yours or mine. Now, quite honestly, we don't know if what you and I see is the totality of what is actually there, or if some people from beyond the Great Desert might think we're as blind as we think the men who can't tell this from this.
That's weird.
I know. In class, the magisters usually have every boy come to the front and attempt the test, just because so many of the girls who can see the differences can't believe that everyone else can't see them too. It's pretty humiliating. Actually, I think it's worse for the girls who can't see it either. The boys aren't expected to pass. The girls who can't see it feel awful. Tangent. The point to remember, even if you don't believe it now, is that color doesn't inhere anything. Things reflect or absorb colors from light. You think this cloth is green? It's not. Really, it's a cloth that absorbs all colors except green.
This is us saving color theory for later?
No, you don't. I'm not going to get drawn into more tangents. The point is, light is primary. This cloth in a dark room is worthless to you. Obviously, you can take the religious significances pretty deep, but you and I are only going to talk about the physical, not the metaphysical. You can draft green light. There are only a couple of ways for you to do that. The best is to have green things around you, especially if you have lots of them, especially if you have lots of different hues and tones available.
So, like a forest?
Exactly. That's why before the unification, the green goddess Atarat was worshipped in Hrothgar and the Blood Forest more than anywhere else. Green drafters flocked the forests and the verdant plains because they were more powerful there than anywhere else. In turn, those lands were dominated by the green virtues and the green vices, either simply because of the sheer amount of green being drafted there or because Atarat was real. Take your pick.
That I don't understand.
We'll worry about all that later. The second best way to draft is to have spectacles, like these.
She reached into her pack and pulled out a little cotton pouch. Loosening the drawstring, she withdrew a pair of green spectacles.
You don't draft green.
No, I don't.
They're for me?
Usually there's a little ceremony, but it amounts to a congratulations.
Kip took the spectacles gingerly. They had perfectly round lenses set in a thin iron frame. He put them on his face. Liv stepped close and measured where the arms of the spectacles passed over his ears. Kip could smell her. Somehow, after a full day skimming across the entire sea and fighting pirates and then baking in the sun, she smelled wonderful. Of course, Kip hadn't been this close to a woman very often, except his mother, usually covered with sweat or vomit on the nights he was unlucky and had to carry her home. Issa had smelled good too, but different than Liv. Issa had barely crossed Kip's mind in the last days. He'd thought about her, but there was something hollow there. He'd let himself daydream before about kissing Issa someday, but maybe that had been more because she was there than she was perfect for him. Or because she was there and Liv wasn't, and Kip needed something to distract him from thinking about Liv. And now, here Liv was, She'd measured both sides, and she took his spectacles off, and was carefully bending the arms to fit behind his ears.
Your right ear's higher than your left.
My ears are lopsided?
Don't worry, mine are too. Really, most people's are off a little bit, just not quite so much.
I've got freakish ears.
Ah, gotcha.
Oh, Holmes, but... beard.
Liv smiled, self-satisfied, and gave the nose pieces a final bend, then propped the spectacles on his face.
There. You might have to play with them to make them more comfortable, but they aren't really meant to be on your face all day long anyway.
He looked around, and was not terribly surprised to see that most everything had a greenish tinge through the green glass.
What you're seeing is white light from the sun reflected off of surfaces, then filtered through your lenses. So if you're surrounded by white marble walls or something, you'll be able to draft almost as much as if you were in a forest. The lenses aren't as good as drafting from natural greens, but it's better than nothing. You can't just look at anything, though. Look around. You see how some things really look green and others don't? Like, if you look at this cloth, what color does it appear to be?
She drew another cloth out of her bag.
Red.
It is red.
Kip looked over his glasses, and though the cloth's tone was changed a little, it was indeed red.
So how does that work?
The spectacles will only help if there are surfaces that are reflecting green to you. White surfaces work best because white is all the colors together. Much less good, but sometimes possible. We'll be drafting through your lenses when looking at yellow or blue surfaces, since green is a secondary color.
Lost me there.
Oh, so now you want the color theory. For your purposes, if you need to draft, the spectacles will help most if you can find things that are either white or light colored. Ripe wheat would work, a spruce tree won't.
I think I can remember that.
The whole things aren't the color they are thing really didn't make sense. But he suspected he could wrestle with that later.
Good. So that covers source. For the time being. I don't want to beat this to death, and I'm sorry you don't get to have the ceremony, because maybe that helps this sink in. Those spectacles are now your most important possession. Not only do most drafters have to save up for months or even a year to afford one pair of spectacles, but everyone then immediately saves for a spare pair. If you get rich, or if the Prism orders it, I suppose, you can have a custom pair made by the lens grinders. They can give you a darker or lighter green, or adjust the frame for fit or looks, but without your spectacles, you're close to powerless. I know you've been with the Prism, but he's the exception. He doesn't need spectacles. His eyes don't halo. He can use as much magic as he wants. The rules don't apply to him. Even the rules for Prisms don't seem to apply to him. Can you imagine anyone else coming in here alone and simply taking over? From the Hrothgari? And the funny thing is, they're going to take it. They won't like it, but they'll...
I don't give a good god's damn what your paper says! There's no way you'll...
Kip looked up just as a man plunged past their balcony. He landed far below in the bay, and Kip saw him struggle to the surface, spluttering, his rich clothes billowing in the water. Kip saw another man plunge past the balcony. He splashed in the bay, almost on top of the governor. There was a gigantic burst of light.
So help me, the next one of you isn't going to land in water.
Kip expected to hear gunshots. Surely the governor had guards. But there was nothing. They took it.
That's my father. That's my father?
Gavin imposed his will, and the world took it.
Will. That's next, right?
Corvin Danavis approached Garriston as the sun set. The outer walls of Garriston, of course, had long ago been demolished. During the Prism's War, Corvin never thought of it as the False Prism's War. He had set men to working on rebuilding them, but there just hadn't been time. The outer walls had been built to shield a city of hundreds of thousands. At the time of the war, there had been perhaps 90,000. There had been no way to protect them all. The irrigation canals that could have been watering all the land between the outer walls and the inner walls were broken, except for one or two. But the inner walls still stood, as did the ladies. The ladies, mostly now stripped of associations with the goddess Anat, guarded each gate. Each was an enormous white statue incorporated into the wall itself. Each had represented an aspect of Anat. The guardian was the colossus standing astride the entrance to the bay, The mother guarded the south gate, heavily pregnant, defiant, dagger bared. The hag guarded the west gate, leaning heavily on a staff. The lover lay across the river gate to the east. For reasons Corvin had never understood, the lover was depicted perhaps in her 30s, while the mother was depicted as very young, perhaps still in her teens. Each was carved of the most expensive, faintly translucent white marble, such as was only available in Perea. Orholim alone knew how they chipped so much this far. The statues, luckily, had been coated in the finest sealed yellow Luxon, all of one piece. Astounding work. The city had been invaded at least 3 times, and still the ladies were unmarked, even after the fiery devastation of the great conflagration. Anat, the Lady of the Desert, the Fiery Mistress, the Sub-Red, had been the goddess of all hot passions. Wrath, protection, vengeance, possessive love, and furious lovemaking. When Lucidonius had taken the city for Orholim and eliminated the cult, his followers had wanted to tear down the statues, which, granted, would have taken some powerful drafters. Famously, Lucidonius had stopped them.
Tear down only what is false.
Several times in the intervening centuries, zealous prisms had wanted to tear down the pagan relics anyway, but each time the city had threatened war. Until the Prisms' War, Garriston had had enough military power that a threat of going to war with her was daunting. Corvin had never approached the lover at sunset. As with the other ladies, her body was incorporated into the gate. She lay on her back, back arched over the river, feet planted, her knees forming a tower on one bank, hands entwined in her hair, elbows rising to form the tower on the other bank. She was clad only in veils, and before the war, a portcullis could be lowered from her arched body into the river, its iron and steel hammered into shape so that they looked like a continuation of her veils. But in the war, the portcullis had been broken and never replaced. The sight of her still took Corvin's breath. With the sun setting, the thin yellow Luxon sealing the statue, usually nearly invisible, was set alight. The yellow was like golden bronze skin, fading slowly as Corvin walked and the sun sank, finally leaving only a welcoming silhouette, a wife waiting a bed for her long absent husband. It sent a pang through him. He could never come here without thinking of Kura, his first wife, Liv's mother. Kura had greeted him like that once, lying abed, clad only in veils, deliberately mimicking the lover when Corvin had returned to her. Even now, 18 years later, grief and remembered desire and joy and love twined in his breast. Corvin had remarried in Recton 2 years after Cora's death, but marrying Elle had been more to give Liv a mother than for love. 3 years later, Elle had been murdered by an assassin who'd finally tracked Corvin down. Corvin had considered moving, but the Alcaldesa begged him to stay, and Kip was there, so he'd stayed. But he'd not remarried again. Not even with the overwhelming number of women for every man in Recton, and the constant carping of the would-be matchmakers. He couldn't love as he had loved before. Losing another woman he loved as much as he'd loved Kura would kill him. And it wasn't fair to ask another woman to act as mother to his daughter, if he wasn't willing to love her with his whole heart. Corvin no longer had a whole heart to give. He trudged on, past farms with their thin but ripening crops of spelt and barley, trying not to look at the lover stretched luxuriously before him. Reaching the gate, which opened through the spilling tresses of her hair, he joined the line of men and women heading back into the city, brushing past those heading back out for the night. He kept his eyes down as he passed between 2 Hrothgari guards who had still been on their mother's knees during the war. They were barely paying any attention to the stream of people passing by them, however. One was leaning against the lover's cascading hair, his foot propped against the rippling stone. His straw patassos, the characteristic Hrothgari broad-brimmed hat, thrown back to hang from his neck, now that the sun wasn't beating down on them.
What do you think he's here for?
Scorch me if I know, but they say he threw Governor Crassos into the bay.
Corvin couldn't hear any more without pausing, and pausing meant inviting attention. Inviting attention might mean making eye contact, and with Corvin's red-haloed eyes, that wasn't a good idea. So someone powerful had come to Garriston, But who was powerful enough to throw a governor in the bay? Corvin didn't know anything about this Governor Crassos, but the Rathgari royal family had half a dozen young princes. Most likely, one of them had been sent to help oversee the withdrawal from Garriston. No one else would dare throw a Rathgari governor into the sea. An impulsive prince actually might be better for Corvin's purposes than a comfortable governor. Harder to deal with at first, but more likely to prepare for war. And war was what Corvin was bringing, like it or not. As he passed through the city, he found himself analyzing it like the general he used to be. King Haradol might be a monster, but the Rathgari were the occupiers. Who would the people of Garriston join, and would they join enthusiastically or not? As Corvin walked, he paid particular attention to the Rathgari soldiers. At times, the men walked singly, running errands for their commanders, or simply heading back to barracks or out to taverns. He saw a soldier get jostled on accident by a vendor closing his carpet stall who backed up too quickly. The soldier pushed past like it was an annoyance, but never checked his back. The vendor, a native Tyrian, apologized respectfully, but without fear. This wasn't a city on the verge of revolt. The Tyrians had grown accustomed to being occupied. The Rathgari were the fourth satrapy to do so, and this was their second time around. Not every nation got a turn in the occupation and spoils. Perea had had the first 2 years, and if they'd had the richest spoils to steal, they'd also had the task of putting down the most rebels. The Elysians had ostensibly fought on Dazen's side, and had no central government anyway, so they didn't get a turn. The Abornians had preferred to trade with both sides, and had entered the fight only after the Battle of Sundered Rock. They didn't get a turn either. That left the Pereans, the Atashians, the Blood Foresters, and the Rathgari. In that order, if Corvin remembered correctly. It made sense that the people of Garriston would have their favorites, or at least those less hated, among their occupiers. It took Corvin only a bit of mental shuttling to figure that with the Pereans replacing the Rathgari, this would be the third time Garriston had endured the Pereans. The most easily tolerated occupiers were about to be replaced by the most hated ones. But the questions his observations didn't answer was just how much fear was mixed with the hatred of the Pereans. The Pereans had put down rebels both times they'd ruled. Maybe their cruelty meant the Tyrians would think twice before taking up weapons. It might mean they would take them up more quickly. Corvin didn't know. Couldn't know without spending a lot of time in the city. Time he didn't have. The city was more cosmopolitan than it had been the last time he had visited, some 10 years ago. Before the war, Garriston had been as populous and diverse as any rich port city in the world. After the war, everyone who could leave had left, especially those who looked like they were from elsewhere. Tensions had run high. During that time, the only people in Garriston were native Tyrians and their occupiers of the moment. Apparently, with each round of occupation, a few traders and soldiers had stayed and intermarried with locals. Corvin saw two shopkeepers chatting as they swept out their open stalls with straw brooms. One woman had the traditional Tyrian caramel skin and dark full brows and wavy hair, while the woman next to her had skin like honey and ash blonde hair, rare even for the Rathgari. They were dressed almost identically, bangles on their wrists, long flax skirts, hair tied back with scarves. Corvin passed an alley where children played gada together, kicking and passing a ball of wrapped leather. There were more obviously Tyrian-blooded children than any other kind, but the teams were mixed. A few mothers had gathered to watch, and they stood close to each other, regardless of what Corvin would have guessed were their origins. Not a powder keg, that was good. A radical shift in power and lawlessness in a city where neighbor hated neighbor would have invited wanton bloodshed. Garriston had seen enough of that. The water market, basically an outsized version of what Recton had, was nearly empty except for a few food vendors offering quick meals to passing soldiers and those who had otherwise missed dinner. Corvin bought a few skewers of rabbit and fish marinated in a fiery Elysian pepper sauce and kept walking. Before he headed to the Travertine Palace, Corvin walked to the Hag's Gate. Here, like the Guardian's Gate and the Lover's Gate, the statue was worked into the wall. But this time, Corvin had no interest in the statue. He had come to watch the soldiers. The gates had closed for the night, though it had doubtless been a long time since raiders had dared move against the city itself. The soldiers who stood at the top of the wall were joking, even drinking when their superiors left. Corvin had seen archers atop the Hag's Crown and at the top of the Hag's Staff, the two towers on either side of the gate. But after the two women settled in, quivers laid down, bows unstrung, they never made a circuit of their respective posts. So, soldiers with little discipline. Soldiers who had become city guards through no fault of their own. In the first year of an occupation, the soldiers might be sent against raiders and brigands or patrol the river's length. After that, they retreated to the city and became guards. The soldierly duties came to seem extraneous, and discipline slipped. Sitting watch in towers where there was never anything to watch for soon became a post where soldiers gambled and drank. Corvin headed toward the Travertine Palace. Of course, there was no way they were going to let some peasant walk in off the street and meet their prince, so when he got close to the front gate, he ducked into an alley. After Karras had been captured, Corvin had scattered King Haradol's camp enough to decide that any attempt at rescue would be suicide. Then, as they'd rendezvoused with other generals, swelling the army, most likely with forced levies, they turned south. Corvin had headed back to a cave outside of Rectan. He was almost disappointed that thieves had never found his cache. When Rectan's Alcaldesa had told Corvin that he and his daughter could stay, he'd hidden away everything that could connect him to the war, both for his new home's sake and his own. He'd shaved off his distinctive beaded mustache and traded rich clothes and weapons for flaxen pants and a dyer's shop. What had seemed meager gold in his pockets then was now a fortune in his eyes. But in the intervening years, it had all been unspendable. No one in Rectan had gold coins, especially not stamped with a Blood Forester's satrap's face. So now he pulled out the long folded semi-tunic, swept off a portion of the ground with his hand, and laid it on it. Next came a broad leather belt embossed with crocodiles with tiny ruby eyes in emerald-dotted swamps with diamond-eyed herons. Last, he drew out Harbinger, the sword that had passed to him only when the last of his elder brothers died. A young boy sat on the curb opposite him, silently watching, quizzical. Corvin tried to ignore him. He stripped off his long shirt and pulled out a mirror. With mirror and a skin of water, he did his best to clean himself up. Then he dried himself with a dirty shirt and pulled on his rich clothes. There was nothing to be done about his boots or pants, but the semi-tunic and the stress was going to have him sweating enough as it was. After packing his things and strapping Harbinger onto his belt and pushing his hair into something resembling order, he rounded the corner, approaching the gate.
I need to see whoever's in charge.
Apparently, they didn't know if he meant the governor or the prince.
Whoever threw the governor in the bay. It's an emergency.
Got no reason not to waste his time. He's not exactly giving us cause to screen his visitors carefully.
We'll take you right to him, sir.
They didn't even ask his name. Corvin followed them, astounded by his good fortune. Apparently the prince, presumably a younger prince, or the Hrothgari wouldn't dare behave this way, hadn't been endearing himself to the common soldiers. Even more incredibly, the soldier marched him straight to the council room. Corvin hadn't been there in 16 years.
I've got a man here. Says he wants to talk to the man in charge. Says it's an emergency. I don't know who he is. Looks pretty important.
The council room guard, a tall, serious Hrothgari, ushered Corvin in.
Name?
Corvin stepped inside. The Hrothgari prince was leaning over a table in the council room, his back to Corvin.
Corvin Danavis.
There was a huge, both tall and thickly muscled, ebony guard standing across from the prince, his eyes hard, studying Corvin, taking note of the sword at his side. He wore all black. This prince had some nerve pretending to have his own blackguard. When the Chromeria found out about that, it would not be pleased.
Corvin Danavis. He says he has an emergency message, my Lord Prism.
It was like lightning hit all three men at once. The blackguard, an actual real blackguard for Orholm's sake, had two pistols out and his blue spectacles on half a breath after Corvin's name was announced. The Prism, not a princeling, Gavin Guile himself, stood and turned. His lip curled,
General Danavis, it's been too long.
Gavin kept his face, carefully neutral. After 16 years, Corvin Danavis still looked fit, healthy, and sharp as ever. His skin was deeply tanned, no doubt to try to cover the freckles and look as Tyrian as possible, and there was no sign of his famous beaded mustache. His blue eyes were only about half haloed with red, not much more than when Gavin had last seen him. The lines, both smile lines and deeper worry lines, were new, however. His eyes flicked to Iron Fist, and then he looked dismayed.
Commander Iron Fist, please relieve this man of his weapons and reprimand the guards. Carefully, yes?
You wish me to leave you with this traitor, Lord Prism?
Iron Fist knew as well as Gavin did that the original guards who'd allowed Corvin into the palace would have beaten a hasty retreat, which meant he'd have to go after them and wouldn't be close if things got out of hand. Gavin nodded curtly. Iron Fist lowered the hammer of one pistol and tucked it into his belt without taking his eyes or the other pistol off Corvin. He walked forward and took Corvin's sword, eyes flicking only briefly to it in appreciation. After putting the sword and Corvin's bag in a small closet off the main room, he put away his other pistol and frisked Corvin briskly. Before turning to go, Iron Fist looked one more time at Gavin. Gavin nodded fractionally. The door closed behind Iron Fist. Gavin looked around the room. He hadn't been here long enough to know if there were peepholes or eavesdropping tunnels behind the walls. Corvin stood, hands folded, waiting patiently.
Come out onto the balcony, General.
Please, I've not been a general for many years.
Corvin followed Gavin out. Gavin closed the double doors behind them. The balcony was spacious, with a number of chairs and tables spread out so the governor and his visitors could enjoy a view over the bay. It made Gavin glad he'd flung the governor a long way. Dropping the man off the roof onto this wouldn't have been quite as humorous, and he hadn't remembered this balcony protruding quite so far. Lucky.
Bay looks deep enough here.
Gavin leaned on the balcony's railing. The sun was just touching the horizon, setting the sea alight. Pinks and oranges threaded through thin clouds. Suddenly, the lost years were rolling down his cheeks, and he was holding the railing like a drunk, simply to be able to stand.
Oh, it cost too much, Corvin.
Corvin glanced around for spies, checking the docks, looking back into the council room, up at the roof.
It's good to see you, too. No, no, quit that. You're going to get me started.
Gavin glanced at him. Corvin wore his quirky grin, but his eyes betrayed him. That grin was him trying to give his face something to do, so the depth of his emotion didn't overwhelm him. Suddenly, appearances didn't matter. Gavin embraced his old friend.
It's good to see you, Dazen.
The grand deception had been Corvin's idea from the beginning, 16 years ago. It had been a throwaway idea when he'd proposed it. Neither had really believed that Dazen could beat Gavin. One night, when they'd had a rare respite from the battles and had been sharing one too many skins of wine, Corvin had said,
You could win and simply take Gavin's place.
That's sort of the point of a Prism's War, isn't it? Last man standing? Last prism shining?
No. I mean, you could be Gavin. You two look almost the same. For years, every time the two of you played Scrum, the only way anyone could tell you apart was Gavin's prismatic eyes. You have those now.
Gavin's a peacock. And I'm tall.
Oh, clothes can be changed. And he wears lifts in his shoes to make himself as tall as you are. Which would actually make things easier.
He's got that scar, which you gave him, I might add.
I could give you one, too. Nice symmetry to that, huh?
I've gone a while without a haircut. The scar's right along the hairline. I could hide the cut while it was healing.
A few days had passed, and Dazen had asked Corvin to stay after another council of war. After dismissing everyone from the tent, he'd handed Corvin a piece of paper. On it was written a precise description of Gavin's scar.
I was joking.
I'm not. I've got a chirurgeon waiting outside the tent to stitch me up. If anyone notices, we were sparring and had an accident. I'm embarrassed about my clumsiness, so I asked you not to say anything about it.
Dazen, have you thought about what this could mean? You'd have to maintain a charade for years, maybe the rest of your life. Everyone who loves you now would think you dead. Karis.
I lost Karis when I killed her backstabbing brothers.
Are you prepared to be Gavin in her eyes?
Corvin, look at our allies. I've practically sworn a port in every satrapy to the Elysians. I've promised the Atashian throne to Farid Farjad. The cultists joined us in hopes that their strength would help us shatter the Chromeria. Once we win, they'll turn on us. And the blue-eyed demons have been too valuable to us to be content with mercenaries' wages. I expect Horace Farseer to come to me on the eve of the battle with some outrageous demand. Lands, titles, permanent bases. I'll have to agree. After we win, I might renege with one group, but not with all of them. I don't know how it got to this, but however things started, we're the bad guys now.
We're the bad guys. After what they did to Garriston.
In terms of what will happen to the seven satrapies if we win? Yes.
You'll be discovered eventually. You must know that. It can't last forever.
I don't need to fool them for long. A few months. Enough to consolidate the victory. Even if the Spectrum found out, they wouldn't expose me until our enemies are crushed. Some morning, I won't rise from my bed. I can accept that.
But not without options. I mean, if we win, these problems can be handled. We don't know what will happen after we win. If we can take Gavin's army relatively intact and get the Chromeria to capitulate quickly, we could counter.
Do you see the White capitulating quickly?
No.
It's not a good plan. I know that. But it may be the least bad.
We may still lose, I suppose.
You always do look on the bright side.
Now, Corvin pushed Gavin back, wiping his own tears away with the backs of his hands.
I've missed you, friend.
And I you. Now what the hell are you doing here?
The joy at their reunion leached from Corvin's face.
I came to warn the governor that King Harajul's marching here. His army will arrive within 5 days, a week at most. And they captured Karis Whitehook.
I knew about King Harajul, not the other.
I figured. Why else would you be here?
You think he'll attack just after Midsummer's?
The day after. Hrothgari will have withdrawn, but the Parian regiments won't have landed.
I can't believe that Governor Crassus never got word of Haradul's army.
Don't believe it. He did know. The Hrothgari have been withdrawing early. It's a skeleton crew now, so they make sure they all get out of the city before Haradul attacks. Why should they fight to save the city for the Parians?
Bastards.
And cowards and opportunists. What do you intend to do about it?
I intend to hold this city.
And how do you hope to do that?
Put someone in charge who's an experienced hand at lost causes.
What? No. No, you can't. It's impossible. Lord Prism, I'm the enemy general.
And since when don't the conquered sometimes join the victor's army?
Not as generals. Not right away.
It's been 16 years. You're a special case. Corvin Danimus, held in high esteem by both sides of the Force Prism's war. The man who ended the war honorably. A man of unimpeachable integrity and intelligence. It has been a long time. Why could people not believe that we had put it all behind us?
Because I'm the one who put that scar on your temple. And you were none too happy about it. And Gavin's men killed my wife.
There is that.
You don't need me. You're no slouch at command, Lord Prism.
With equal armies and terrain, and me without magic, who would win between us, Corvin?
If you had a good cadre of support staff and your field commanders would tell you the truth, I think...
Corvin, I'm the Prism. Men don't tell me the truth. I ask them, can you do this? And they say yes, no matter what. They want to think the righteousness of obeying the Prism himself will magically help them overcome any obstacle. When I ask for objections to my most flawed plans, I get silence.
It took months and several disasters to get our armies even halfway past that back in the war. We don't have that time now.
Gavin was good at men and magic. Corvin understood numbers and time and tactics. And 16 years ago, he'd certainly been Gavin's master in the art of deception. Together, they'd been unstoppable.
Of course, Rask did massacre my village.
Corvin wasn't working through his fury at losing everyone he knew. He was working through the story people would tell.
I thought the Prism and General Denevis hated each other.
They do, but the Prism needed a general, and Denevis's village was just butchered by King Horridor. He wants revenge.
It worked. It would seem odd, but not incredible. It had been 16 years.
So we're both using each other. I need your tactical genius. You need my army to effect your revenge. I could check in on you openly, making it clear I didn't quite trust you.
I could grumble about slights in front of men. Nothing to undermine their confidence, but enough to make it clear I wasn't comfortable with you.
It could work.
Could. Deception comes quickly to you these days.
Too much practice. You know, if this works, we can be friends again in a year or two. Even in public.
Unless I can serve you better as your enemy, Lord Prism.
I've got enough of those. But fair enough. Now I've got a surprise for you.
A surprise?
I can't be seen giving you something you enjoy, so you'll have to go downstairs without me. The room directly below this one.
They stepped back toward the council room, but Gavin stopped.
How is she?
Karis once seemed like a wilting flower, bowing to her father's every command. Then she became a blackguard, the White's left hand. If anyone can make it, she will.
Masks of seriousness and distrust replaced, they stepped into the council room. Commander Iron Fist had already returned. He stood by the main doors in the loose, casual readiness of a man who spent much of his life guarding, waiting, watching. He was accustomed to inactivity and prepared for violence.
Commander, Corvin Danavis and I find ourselves with a common enemy. He has agreed to help us coordinate Garriston's defenses. Please notify the men that they will be overseen by General Danavis effective immediately. The General will answer only to me.
Yes, my Lord Prism.
Gavin waved his hand in dismissal. Corvin's jaw tightened, but he bowed and left.
Go, my friend, and may finding your daughter repay a tiny measure of the misery you've endured because of me.